We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. When historians look back at the signposts along China's path to economic dominance, this past week might very well include one of them. A stock sell-off on Wall Street in response to China's decision to force its own banks to cut lending.
What makes anybody think that we have any power that we're going to exert over China? China's going to act in its own best interest. We've given these guys a big club, and now we're expressing indignation that they're hitting us over the head with it. It doesn't make sense.
Dan Fitzpatrick, a stock analyst, speaking on CNBC yesterday. China wants to ratchet down its economic growth, at least in the short term. But as we're discovering, decisions made in Beijing have major ripple effects in New York and London and beyond. And as always, our news analyst, James Fallows, is following this story and others. Hi, Jim.
Nice to speak with you, Guy.
Jim, I'm fascinated by this story. Here's how I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong. China tells its banks to tighten up on lending because the central government wants to slow down economic growth, and that then leads to a sell-off on Wall Street.
Indeed. And the way I make sense of this is by thinking of it as a three-act play. Act one would be the past 10 years, when both the Chinese and the U.S. economies were growing pretty strongly, but in unbalanced ways. The Chinese producing more than they consumed, we doing the reverse, and then they're lending to us. Stage two is what we've been through in the last 2 years, when there have been economic shocks around the world. And so stage three is the government response to that, which has been more aggressive in China than in the U.S., where they have more government spending. They've told the banks to lend more money, and the banks have more money to lend. And so it started to work in China. And now we're facing the consequences of that, where the Chinese government is always afraid of inflation, so they've started to put on the brakes. And so that is the effect we're now feeling. China is beginning to recover, but we haven't yet, but we're being caught in their slowdown.
Jim, for several years now, we've been hearing about the rise of China, of course, and the fall of the so-called American Empire, and you've written about this. But I'm wondering if we are actually starting to witness some of those predictions in real time, that is, a China that is increasingly comfortable calling the economic shots for the world.
It's possible there will come a time when I change my tune about this, but my sense is what we're seeing now is the fact of the connectedness of the world's economies, especially China's and the U.S.'s, rather than the Chinese ability to boss us around or have their way.
Jim, yesterday, President Obama signed a piece of legislation that in theory requires Congress to authorize spending only when it can be sure the money is there. And it's being called pay-as-you-go, which to me sounds like an ad for Boost mobile phones. I mean, but how do you actually enforce a law like that? I mean, you effectively have 535 independent agents operating from both chambers under the Capitol Dome, and they're expected to be fiscally responsible?
Well, yes, that is one of several problems. The advantage of tricks like this, tricks in quotes, is they give legislators an excuse to do something which is difficult otherwise. And that difficult thing is either restricting certain benefits or in some cases increasing taxes. The case against them, number one, in an operational sense, is that whenever there's a need for an exception, they find some reason to come up with an exception. The other reason is that during a recession, the imperative is to spend more money and keep the economy going and from collapsing further rather than reducing it with deficit reduction in the long term. So this can be a useful trick, but like any other trick, there are ways around it.
Hmm. Jim, two things about the economy that caught my eye this week. One is that unemployment is only 3% among those who typically earn more than $150,000 a year. And then another story, a devastating article actually in your magazine in The Atlantic that basically says people between the ages of 20 and 35 are doomed to live a life of social and economic malaise.
We have heard for decades now about, in various ways, the polarization of the American income distribution by race, by gender, by educational background, and all the rest. And I think the fact that we're in a downturn has brought this surprising news, number one, as you mentioned, that for people who are well-educated and largely a white man of middle years and above, the unemployment rate is quite low for them. And number two, this article that you mentioned by Don Peck in my magazine, I think is extremely sobering. He mentions, among other things, that the effects of the Great Depression of the 1930s, in a way, never really left the cohort of people who were in their 20s then. There were psychological effects, family formation effects, income stream effects. And so he warns about the dangers of letting this kind of chronic unemployment persist because it can have effects for decades into the future.
That's James Fallows of The Atlantic. You can read his blog entries at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Do not adjust your radio. This isn't just static. It's the sound of a solar flare. Maybe you haven't noticed, but the sun's been a bit quiet over the past couple of years. It was experiencing something called solar minimum. It's a period when sunspots and solar flares are rare. But within the past week, the sun appears to be emerging from its slumber, which is good news for people like Thomas Ashcraft. Thomas is an artist and an amateur radio astronomer, and for the past 20 years, he's been listening to the skies, making and sharing recordings from his home observatory in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thomas Ashcraft, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
First of all, describe what a radio astronomer is.
A radio astronomer studies the sky at radio frequencies rather than optical frequencies. So the optical sky, the visual sky, is just a very small slice of the full electromagnetic spectrum. So there's much more to see and study in radio astronomy than there is in mere visual optical astronomy.
Because normally we think of, you know, the sort of those photographs from the Hubble telescope, these incredible, dramatic photos of faraway galaxies and stars and planets. You're not actually always looking at things. You are listening to things.
Yeah, listening, that's my forte, is listening and recording. And actually, most radio astronomers don't listen to sound. They see the radio input on spectrographs or charts. So to me, if you tune into radio astronomy spectrographs, they can be extremely beautiful, just as beautiful as Hubble images.
Sort of. What have you been hearing this past week?
Well, the past week's been incredibly special. As you mentioned, we're coming out of a very long and almost a weird sunspot minimum. But in the past week, a few active regions appeared on the sun, and one region grew incredibly fast, like in a matter of 2 to 3 days, and started flaring ferociously.
I'm listening to this, and I'm wondering when you actually get sleep, because it sounds like it's been very, very active.
Well, it's kind of nice not to get sleep. I mean, I get sleep, but I tend to get up quite early to before the sun so I can meet it. So it's this exciting time. It was a little bit flat before this.
Now Thomas Ashcraft, I should mention that there's an article about you at Wired.com. And in that article, there's a photograph of your backyard. And it's this sort of network of wires that are strung through the trees. Can you describe what that setup is and how you actually record the sound of space and of the sun?
Those are dipole antennas. So those wires that you can see are then coming into my observatory into a series of shortwave radios. And actually, I'm using old-fashioned VCRs as my audio recorders because they make an eight-hour-long tape and I don't have to attend to them. So I have a incredibly simple radio astronomy observatory built out of simple wires, cast-off shortwave radios, old VCRs that they don't even take at the Salvation Army anymore, I don't think.
You actually use your observatory to make recordings of other phenomena. Okay, to me that sounds like being on the ride Space Mountain at Disney World.
Okay.
What is that sound?
Well, that sound is, now we're switching phenomena into meteor and space dust. So what happens is when a meteor hits the ionosphere, it makes a trail of ionization. That trail or that cone of ionization has the capacity to reflect in a far-off TV or radio transmitter. So what that was the reflections of distant video carriers of TV transmitters. Hmm.
You got to be very careful because I suspect that DJs will start to sample your sounds.
I think that that's all right. I know that people find it musical.
You can dance to some of it.
Well, I do.
That's Thomas Ashcraft. He's an amateur radio astronomer in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thomas Ashcraft, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you kindly.
A few weeks after September 11th, 2001, two famous Harvard Law School professors squared off in a public debate. The question, should the U.S. negotiate with the Taliban? Roger Fisher, a pioneer in the field of conflict resolution, said yes. But Robert Mnookin, the man who runs Harvard Law School's program on negotiation, said
that if one looked at the costs and benefits of entering into negotiation and comparing it with our alternatives, I didn't think negotiation made sense.
Robert Mnookin has taught hundreds of Harvard Law students how to avoid litigation and pursue negotiated agreements. And yet, for someone who's devoted his career to the idea that you can negotiate your way out of almost anything, Mnookin often suggests that there are certain people you just can't reason with, people you have to fight. And some of those examples are laid out in his new book, Bargaining with the Devil. Bob Mnookin, welcome to the program.
It's nice being here.
Now, right now, the Obama administration, along with the Afghan government, is considering whether to negotiate with some elements of the Taliban in hopes of ending the insurgency in Afghanistan. Now, back in 2001, you counseled against doing that when the Taliban was harboring Osama bin Laden. Are the circumstances different now, in your view?
The circumstances are different now. The biggest difference, of course, is the Taliban no longer controls the Afghan government. I think today it makes sense to try to negotiate with some of the Taliban, but not with the top leadership, Mullah Omar and his top lieutenants.
In essence, when the administration, the Obama administration, and when the Afghan government talks about negotiating with certain elements within the Taliban, one could make the argument that they can be reasoned with.
I think it's useful to distinguish between three different sorts of Taliban. Some are what I call the $10 Taliban. With the $10 Taliban, if our government and Karzai's government were to offer them $11 or $12, perhaps they would lay down their arms and join with us in repressing the insurgency. So it makes sense to talk to those sorts. A second group are regional leaders who aren't so ideologically committed to a completely fundamentalist vision, but who in fact want to have better government. For those regional leaders and some of their followers, it might well be possible to persuade them to come in from the cold and join in building a new and better government. The third group, though, the top leaders, Mullah Omar and his top colleagues, I think are very committed to an ideological vision which makes negotiation quite unlikely. And I think negotiating with them, the only kind of deal that could be made would be some kind of regional or even national power sharing, which would be very bad news for women and any cosmopolitans in Afghanistan.
In the book, you use real case studies, so sort of real examples of when it made sense to negotiate and when it didn't. You write about the case of Rudolf Kastner. He was a leader of the Jewish community in Hungary during the Second World War. He eventually made a deal with the notorious Nazi officer Adolf Eichmann. It was a bribe in exchange for allowing about 1,700 Jews to flee to Switzerland. After the war, a court in Israel actually condemned him, called him a collaborator. You argue that it's actually much more complex than that.
It's a tragic case. He ended up making some very hard decisions, and he concluded that, in fact, he thought more lives could be saved by attempting to bribe the Nazis than by resistance, which would be impossible because the Jews in Hungary had no arms. He did negotiate over a period of months with Eichmann, and he did persuade Eichmann, as you indicated, to let some 1,700 people leave Hungary on a train, which eventually reached Switzerland.
And I guess the opposite argument would be that no negotiations should have been held with the Nazis at all, even if it saved 1,700 lives, like in Kastner's case.
I think that argument is silly. The harder questions really relate to, in addition to trying to negotiate to save some lives, was there more that might have been done to encourage others to flee to Romania, to avoid being ghettoized? Could lives, more lives have been saved if more emphasis had been put on that? But I don't criticize Kastner for entering into negotiation in the hope of trying to save lives.
When you sort of look at all these cases, is there a way to figure out when to negotiate and when not to?
The book is really about meeting the challenge of thinking through carefully what your alternatives are and what makes sense. My own view is, if the question is, should you bargain with the devil, if I've got to give a one-sentence answer, it's not always, but more often than you feel like it. And the reason more often than you feel like it, there are two reasons, really. One is, there are a lot of emotional and psychological and political traps that make you want to avoid negotiation. The other problem is, bargaining with the devil usually requires giving the devil something he or she wants. And that often doesn't feel very good because you're really on the altar of pragmatism, sacrificing the search for perfect justice. Justice is often backward-looking, and if you want to make peace, you got to look forward.
Bob Mnookin, thank you so much.
Guy, thank you very much.
That's Robert Mnookin. He heads the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School, and he's the author of the new book, Bargaining with the Devil, When to Negotiate, When to Fight.